Yeah, coming back to Hobart was great, but it was eerie. It was, you know, it's just like a ghost town, having no life in these amazing hotels that are usually full with people, and it was so bleak. But I thought we'd, I don't know, maybe we'd be closed by this time this year. So we're still here and we're busy, and I mean, we're very grateful for it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. For many of us, our chosen vocation is not the one we intended. In fact, most people really have no idea where their future lies and instead wait to let the cards fall before taking the plunge. Life in the hospitality industry is not about the final destination, but the journey that helps form our ideals along the way. Jeff Workman is the head chef of Peacock & Jones in Hobart, Tasmania. Jeff, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks, Huck. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. You didn't intend on becoming a chef. In fact, far from it originally. But what led you to take the leap and do an apprenticeship?
I had absolutely no interest in cooking. I was going to do a carpentry apprenticeship. I did a lot of different odd jobs, just around sort of handyman work, working in factories, working out at Ingleburn unloading trucks. And I guess what sort of turned me onto it was a guy that lived down the road from me. He was a chef. And he just said, look, there's an apprenticeship going down the road at the sports club. Why don't you have a crack? And at the time, there was a show called, I think it was My Restaurant Rules. And it gave you a lot of insight to what was happening in the back of the house, in the kitchen. And I just thought, oh, look, I can peel potatoes, I can peel onions, why not have a go? So literally would just get on my skateboard, skate down the road, rocked up, asked for a job, and I just got the typical, like, look, this is a hard career, the hours are long, it's going to be tough. Are you sure you want to commit to it? And I was like, yeah, why not? I've tried so many other things. If I don't give this a good crack, I really don't know what else I'm going to do. So I actually did 3 weeks there straight, chased up my overtime, and I didn't realize that, you know, underpayment and all that type of thing was like, you know, it was a bit of a part of the career. So that sort of came back at me, and I said, well, you know, I'll go to Fair Work, and got into this big argument with the owner, and I just said, you know what, I'm not doing this. He handed over reluctantly an envelope full of cash, and then I ended up getting a job in a cafe in a shopping center. And that was, you know, I really enjoyed that because it's just, you just had some really cool people working there. It was fairly lighthearted, pretty fun stuff. Not like a strict disciplined kitchen. Ended up doing a year there, and they're like, look, why don't you at least just try one restaurant, you know, fine dining or something in the city. And I was so naive back then, you know, I had no idea about restaurants. I didn't know anything about fine dining or modern Australian cooking. So I just walked around the city just handing in resumes to hotels anywhere and got nothing back. I got a job trial at a little French restaurant that was owned by this really old Japanese guy. Did my trial, and I felt like I couldn't communicate very well with them. So I said, look, I don't think this is going to work out. And then I ended up getting a job offer for GPO at Number One Martin Place, which is still there. And it had 2 hatted restaurants, another restaurant, Mario Perciocco's restaurant at the time, Intermezzo, son of Armando Perciocco. And they had a few different food outlets. And so I got moved around through them. And that was a good experience. And I think that sort of was the beginning of a career in sort of like a more corporate style world of being a chef, you know. So that was a big operation. Ended up going into Prime and Post. So they were 2 separate restaurants, but it was under one kitchen. I don't know how they made it work, but it was busy. You know, you booked lunch, dinner, cooking for two different restaurants. So I think one restaurant was 90 covers, the other one was 60. And that was predominantly a Japanese kitchen. So the head chef was Japanese, sous chef Japanese. It was very strict, very disciplined. And I'd be honest, I sucked. Like I hated it. I would walk to the door and just be like, what am I going to get in trouble for today? But I just kept trying. And it opened up a world of things like, you know, how amazing Japanese knives are, how much pride they take in things like technique and skill. Ended up doing a year there, and I went to work at Glass, and that was crazy. You know, that was, the services were massive, even bigger than what I was doing previously. And they were just these loud, you know, exciting services. You're doing 200 for lunch, 300 for dinner. You're just this one unit moving forward, pushing food out at a, you know, hat level. I think we looked in the guide and it was the biggest one hat restaurant at the time. And, you know, a lot of that came from the head chef, Joe, who had a really strong work ethic. He was there 8 o'clock in the morning till finish every single day. Every single day was on. He was always there while we were all sort of doing a couple of split shifts, but mostly singles. And, you know, he would just be there driving the team forward.
Well, he's a bit of an unsung hero in the industry. What was it like working under him and also Luke Mangan, who obviously is a big part of Glass Bar being his restaurant?
Joe was a hard ass man. Like, he was big Croatian dude. I copped a few bollockings, that's for sure. Fought a lot of tears back at times. But, you know, I think the really important thing there was you got moved from section to section. It didn't matter if you were ready or not for it. You would just sort of be put onto the next section and you would develop how to sort of hold your own ground, how to cook really well. And I think that was the most important thing I learned there, was just how to sort of stand strong in a service and become a part of a team that was, you know, I was on the Friday night service, the Saturday night service, and sort of thinking back, it's like, well, those were the nights where you needed your stronger team. So it feels nice to sort of be a part of that. And again, it's, you know, being sort of exposed to that hotel restaurant, a celebrity chef. I think that was all, without meaning to, it sort of developed my career into, as I said before, sort of bigger operations and hotels and stuff. Sort of opened my eyes up to that type of stuff.
After that period of time working in those hatted restaurants, and you left Sydney and you headed north. Tell us about that decision and the experience you had.
So I was working in a little restaurant at the time, sort of left the city, just wanted a break from it. And just a mate of mine, he called me up one day and he's like, would you be interested to, you know, come and help me out on a island resort? And I pretty much said no straight away. It's like, why would I want to do that? And it was about 20 minutes later, I was like, you know what, fuck it, why... Why am I holding myself back? You know, so many chefs move out and go overseas. You know, this could be this, you know, right direction to sort of start doing that. And so I resigned at my job, and probably 3 months later was plonked on Daydream Island, north of Brisbane, 40 degrees, wet season, stinking hot, really uncomfortable. And it was, again, another big operation, but it was tough, you know, for the amount of work you put in. The food wasn't amazing. We went through, five executive chefs in the 2 years I was there. So that was a massive learning curve in terms of just, you know, being a part of a remote area as well, which sort of leads you into, you know, working like that. So from there, coming down to Tassie.
Well, tell us a bit about what you were cooking on Daydream Island. You said it wasn't the best and you had so many executive chefs, but back then, what were you cooking?
Oh, it was my first night there was, you know, they had things like fish I'd never heard of. So red throat emperor, spangled emperor, I was on the hot section and I'm just looking at all these different species going, I'm lost now. I don't even know what fish I'm meant to be cooking. So like that, they also had a fisherman for the island, and he would just bring in all this amazing fish, and we would take what we needed, scaled it, gutted it, portioned it. And sadly, a lot of it would just end up sitting in the fridge because I just feel like the poor management, a lot of those things just didn't get taken care of. So in terms of the food, it was just really basic stuff, and a lot of surprises on the way. I got into work one day and they're like, oh, there's a breakfast basket on. Like, I didn't even know we do breakfast. Yeah, you do breakfast, you do lunch, you do dinner, and tapas and pizzas. And it was just like that. The list was never ending. So it's just a massive crowd pleaser. You had two outlets. One could seat 200 covers, the other one 300, and you'd have 600 people on the island. So, the numbers didn't really add up.
Well, as you just briefly mentioned, you made the journey to Tasmania. What triggered that? Because Tasmania is really where you've made a name for yourself.
Well, I was just talking to a guy on Daydream and he said, oh, I'm moving to Tassie. I'm like, oh. Okay, never considered moving there. I'd always look at it on the weather report and just cold. But I like the cold weather, and spoke to my wife who I'd met on the island. And we're like, we could either go two ways. We could go do something like work in the mines and try and make some serious cash, or, we can go and see what Tasmania's about, maybe do a few months there and just move around. And so I looked online and Sapphire came up. And I noticed that Hugh Whitehouse was executive chef. And I remembered him from when I was an apprentice. He had two hats at Darley's, regional restaurant of the year 2 years in a row. So I was just like, we got to go there. Applied for a job. They got back to us straight away, offered us a 6-month contract. And the funny thing about that is, they had this incentive. If you stick out your 6 months, you get $1,000. And then, so that was like a real good goal. So we're like, yep, let's do it. Ended up being there for 3 years. We got offered to stay on. We got really well looked after there. It was probably my favorite job. It was a lot of self-development. You were doing things like cooking classes, in-room dining. So you'd cook for some guests if they liked. A lot of engagement. And that's what the place is about, sort of tailoring to the guests' needs, requirements. The staff ratio was, the amount of staff was outweighed to the actual guests staying there. So it was really impressive little boutique hotel.
You briefly touched on Hugh Whitehouse. What sort of impact did he have on your career, and has there been other chefs to really make a mark on who you are?
Yeah, so Hugh, he really encouraged me to do what I'm doing now. Simon, who was sous chef at the time, I really enjoyed working with him. He sort of would always have the saying, you can do it. However, you can cook however you want, as long as we get the same result, I don't mind. So there was always a bit of freedom around him that I felt really comfortable around. As for Hugh, he was just a pain in the ass and just gave you a hard time. But, he was tough but fair. In terms of other chefs, I did a year at the Observatory Hotel at Galileo. And that was under Masahiko Yamada, so Chef Yomo. He had just sort of taken over Galileo after Haru had left. And he, I at that time, I was looking for another job, wanted to work somewhere like Key or Rockpool. And then a mate of mine was there as well. And he's like, oh, you're on a break for 2 weeks. Do you mind coming in helping us out? We don't have enough chefs. So I said, yeah, sure. Went and helped out and just loved it. I loved that, just had a sense of pride from the recipes were written in French, the dockets were called in French. All the chefs were so disciplined. They were all about your technique, improving your skill. It wasn't about the money. It was just about sort of being the best you can be. And I remember sort of one conversation I had with Yomo one night, you know, probably drunk in the back of a taxi. He just turned to me and said, you know, being a chef isn't, it's not a shit job. Like, it's a profession. You need skill, you need management, you need artistic flair. So don't think it's a shit job. You know, you can take this seriously. You need to be a gentleman in the kitchen. Like, I don't like it when people swear in the kitchen. I don't like yelling. I like it when it's calm and everyone's in control. So that really opened my eyes up because, you know, before that, a lot of chefs were either, they'd been previously been kitchen hands that have worked their way up into the kitchen, or even a lot of high school dropouts sort of just falling into a chef job. So that made a real impact on me on how I suppose, you know, I wanted to progress and just, I don't know, I guess be more of a manager than, you know, a section chef or whatever.
Let's talk about Peacock and Jones. You're involved from the beginning with that. What was it like at the beginning creating your food and also, you know, the first sort of head chef role for you?
Yeah, so look, it was tough because you've got so many other people giving you their opinion and their vision on something. Originally, it was meant to be a wine tapas bar, then a French bistro, and, you know, just being told to sort of put a curry on, cook this, cook that, I just started to ignore it and just started to sort of try and develop my own style and just cook the way I wanted and, you know, use flavours that I wanted. As for being my first head chef role, it was kind of tough because you don't really know, you don't understand the way the seasons work in Tasmania. So that was a huge learning curve. You know, I was out one night with a mate and he's like, oh, you know, what are you doing with your tomatoes at the moment? I said, well, I haven't got them on the menu. It's like, you're 3 weeks late. And that, you know, the penny dropped. Was like, oh, you gotta be on the ball down here. You know, they do things their way according to season. So you just got to know where you're at, know what's available, even be, you know, two seasons ahead so you're on top of your menu. As for the food, we just cook fairly simply, try to look after the produce as best we can, care for it as best we can. We've got some amazing producers down here from, you know, Mimosa Park Pork, Strelley Field Duck, a lot of awesome veg growers. So that sort of dictates how you cook. I think everyone really looks forward to summer. But, you know, you just got vibrant plates of food, really abundant. Winter does get tough, but you got to just got to get creative with cabbage and kale and stuff like that. But, you know, but you get beautiful pumpkin and squash. We've got a new supplier at the moment, Early Bird Market Farm. They've got these amazing carrots and beetroots. So there's kind of always stuff floating around, but it does. It gets to the pointy end and, you know, you really do look towards summer for a lot of inspiration when it comes around.
Tell us about the, you know, the connection with farmers and how long it took you to get that in order and how vital is it to what you do right now?
That was a little bit harder than I thought because they're so small that they only supply, or they can only supply a certain amount of restaurants. But sort of, I guess, as we developed a bit of a reputation, you know, we had a lot of suppliers coming to us. We were approached by Mimosa Park, Strelley Field were on board with, and a really good veg supplier, Longley Organic Farm, he's slowed down a bit, but, you know, we used to get a lot of stuff from him. We use Lindell lamb. We pretty much clean out the butcher every week because it's just so busy, you know. And again, that just says that they're a small supplier. And we just, you know, it's like a free rein. Whatever you've got, send it to us. If you've got lamb saddles, we'll take them, rumps, anything. you know, we're not a big restaurant. We're not a big kitchen. We don't have a lot of storage space. So we'd love to get the whole beast in, but, you know, I guess this is the next best thing to that.
Can you give us a sense of where you're at with your cooking and what your cooking style is? Is there a dish or two that you can talk us through that exemplifies your style of cooker?
Sure. I guess, you know, care for the product. With the ducks that we've been getting, we get them in once a week. We break them down. We age them for minimum 7 weeks, get them nice and dry. You know, the legs can go into duck confit or even we'll do a petit vier with them. So we're trying to use everything. We're giving it a lot of care and, you know, a lot of cooking on the bone. So we cook the ducks on the crown. We cook, you know, the pork chop. In terms of dishes, I really like cooking the duck. You know, we can do it with duck heart. We'll make a sauce out of the livers. And as I said, you know, fairly simply, we'll just put them with some vegetables or fruit or preserves and just kind of leave the plate nice and clean. As long as everything's cooked perfectly, seasoned well, sort of that's all I really want to do because we've got, you know, we're in a hotel. We're essentially a hotel restaurant. We've got to keep it fairly approachable. There might be people that are just down for a night in the hotel and they just want a simple meal. We don't want them to feel like they can't come down and have something to eat and then just go back and rest. But on the other hand, we can do a tasting menu if people like and they can have a bit of a dining experience. That's probably where we're at. A lot of sort of old French technique, I think. That was a lot of my training. And I think at that time in Sydney, you know, you had the best restaurants, places like Bacasse, Assiette. It was almost like Sydney was French at the time. So that's where a lot of my influence on the cooking comes from.
The food offering in Tasmania has changed exponentially in the last 5-10 years. What's exciting you about the Hobart and Tasmanian food scene at the moment?
I think it's actually been really admirable to see a lot of restaurants not shut from COVID. I think they've been really brave and changed the way they're running their business, whether it's less days, which is great. It gives the chefs time off. They're not feeling the pressures of having to be open all the time. And it means a lot of the restaurants are booked out now. If you don't come down, you know, a month, you know, booking a month in advance, you're going to get stuck. There's wait lists, you know, our weekends are wait lists. I know there's, you know, some of the better restaurants in Hobart, you can't get in months out. So you might as well be planning for next year. I think in terms of being what's exciting, I actually feel like Launceston is pretty exciting. There's some awesome restaurants up there and kind of go under the radar, but there's some really good cooking on up there, some, you know, chef-owned little restaurants up there that are just cooking amazing dishes. It's like, you know, Hobart sort of steals the spotlight from them a lot. But, yeah, I think, you know, they're on par, if not better sometimes, in what's happening here. So I think around the state, you know, you can find these great little restaurants. So I think the whole state can be it's all moving forward and it's really exciting to see.
Now, you haven't been at Peacock and Jones for this whole period of time that it's been open. An opportunity came up in Binlong Bay. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, you know, we got approached to open or start up a restaurant that was going to cook over fire. So there was going to be we had a wood grill put in. There was an existing wood oven and it was just trying to sort of get in with a local fisherman and just, again, cook really simply but, you know, with beautiful flavour from the flame. And that was a tough one because you're in such a remote area. You're in a really small sort of residential area where people have lived there, you know, their whole lives and they sort of have an expectation and you don't, you know, you're outside of that expectation. So you get questions like, where are the palmies? Where are the burgers? Fair enough. You know, a lot of them were pensioners. So I think it just didn't really work. A lot of the tourists enjoyed it, but where, you know, COVID crept in, you could really sense something was changing because we really started to slow down a lot after the summer holidays, and it just didn't feel right. And you're just watching the news and you're like, oh, you know, it's happening over there. It's not going to affect us. It'll get contained. And all of a sudden, you know, you're just in a world of hurt. No one knows what they're doing. So that, you know, the owners had to sort of change it up, the business model, and sort of become a lot more family friendly with the menu. And we were already sort of working into that, which took away what we wanted to do originally, which, you know, would have been really nice to be a bit of a destination sort of dining spot. And then my wife fell pregnant and it became a bit of a complicated pregnancy. So during COVID, she was having to drive back and forward to Launceston by herself because, you know, I wasn't allowed to go with her in the hospital. And one day she was just like, I can't be doing this. I need support. And I was feeling the same way. So we just decided, you know, we'll move back to Hobart. And I was always getting messages from my exec chef jokingly getting me back to work here. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm asking if it's still going. So, and yeah, that we worked on that. And, yeah, coming back to Hobart was great, but it was eerie. It was, you know, it's just like a ghost town. Coming into work to have discussions with the general manager, having no life in these amazing hotels that are usually full with people, and, you know, the full restaurants are full bars. Yeah, it was so bleak. And we didn't know what we were sort of going in for. I thought we'd, I don't know, maybe we'd be closed by this time this year. So, look, we're still here and we're busy, and, I mean, we're very grateful for it.
How much has changed you in this time, given the experiences that you've had over the last year and a half? And has it changed your cooking and the offering as well?
It's changed me. You know, I've had two children since. That's changed me a lot. I'm a lot more tired. a lot more tired. But I think it's definitely made me a lot more patient, rather than just, you know, don't lose your temper. Just roll your eyes. You know, we've all been through a whole world of shit. So, you know, worse things can happen than someone overcooking something or something not being done properly. You know, and also cooking, it's, again, just simplifying things. Don't take it too seriously, because we can all go through all that again and it all gets taken away. And you know what? All the press or the reputation, all that, it can get taken away from you so easily. And what I think a lot of us found was a lot of that didn't really matter. You know, the brutal truth was, you got to be happy. You got to be enjoying what you're doing. You got to be, you know, making your guests happy. That's really changed the way I'm thinking. It's just go to work, enjoy it, and make changes at work that are going to make people happy at work. It's been mostly positive.
For someone who had no interest in food or cooking when they were young, you've made a hell of a career out of it. What is it that you love about restaurants and cooking?
I love the teamwork. I love feeling like it's, you know, a part of playing, you know, a sport almost. You know, you, as the head chef, you're the captain. Every night you have to perform. You have to lead everyone to, you know, almost a victory, almost a win against these dockets that are coming at you. Complaints, you know, you got to really stand hard and lead by example. That's what I really enjoy about it. It's like just, yeah, being part of the team and also working with your hands, creating. I think a lot of pleasure comes from just making things. And, you know, when you're even just simply making a staff meal, whether it's, you know, a beef braise or whatever, it's like you've made this delicious dish and you're sharing it with people. I think there's a lot of enjoyment that comes from that. Also, even just interacting with the guest, a lot of guest engagement, taking food out, talking with them when they, you know, walk past the pass and they want to have a little chat, and, you know, it's all positive. I mean, that's where a lot of the satisfaction comes from. It's not who's the best. It's not who's number one. It's like, you know, you did a good job in the night. You've made someone happy. They've come in and you've blown their expectations away, and they come back. And it even leads into the front of house. It's like teaching them, encouraging them, watching them develop, watching them get excited about putting the plates of food down. Yeah, I love hearing them explain the dishes with so much passion. And some of these people have never even worked in food. They're not interested in food, and they just develop this passion for it. So it's like, you know, when you see that, that's, yeah, you feel really good about it.
You've had some pretty big changes in your life over the last year and a half or so, with new family members, change of restaurants back to where you were cooking before that. What are you looking forward to, and what's your goals sort of in the next couple of years?
I guess I'd love to work on sort of more time with the family. You know, you're stuck at work all day and you miss out on a lot. And I was having a conversation with a mate that came down not too long ago, and he used to be a chef, and he's got two kids, and he said to me, look, it's, you know, it's okay now when they're not at school and they're really young, they don't notice. But, you know, when they're going to school and you're working on the weekends, that's when it becomes hard. And he just took this change in job career. He's just working at a mushroom farm, working 3 a.m. till midday. And he's like, it's great. I get to pick my kids up every single day, and I get to be with them on the weekend. So I think some more of a balance with family life is important. I look forward to teaching them. I don't want them to be chefs. I don't, you know, like, I won't encourage it, but if they want to, then for sure go for it. And yeah, you know, I'd love to sort of pass on a lot of knowledge and do things at home with them in that way. But I guess, you know, I think that's the most important thing, is just watching them grow. And all this, you know, restaurant stuff, you can put it behind you and just to be able to put it behind you and spend more time with your family is definitely a goal for me. More sustainable living, more healthy living, growing more veggies at home, getting the kids interested in vegetables, in eating, you know, more nutrient dense food. I think that's the most important thing to me, is just being there for the kids, I think.
Well, I think that's a wonderful sentiment and a great thing to focus on. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today, Jeff, to hear your story. And I loved the meal that I had at Peacock and Jones when I was in Tasmania. It feels like so long ago. Please keep in touch, and we'll no doubt catch up again soon.
Thanks, Huck. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.